Les conférences du Collège de France.
Good morning and welcome to our third lecture on the history we share with fish, nos ancêtres les poissons. Today we're going to talk about the origin of bones and teeth. We're going to go deeper in time than we have with the previous lectures. What I'd like to do is to start just by going back where we've been and where we're going. Well, where do we begin? We began with a question. And that question is, how did fish evolve to live on land? And we talked for some time about how paleontologists like myself construct field expeditions, how we go about planning expeditions around the world to discover fossils that can tell us about these great transitions in the history of life, such as the one we're focusing on here with the transition from fish to land animal. And I should say, we're deploying the tools that our colleagues in paleontology have done for over a century. And indeed, colleagues from around the world have found a number of fossils, like this one we found here, that tell us some great details, anatomical details, about how this transition happened. Now, once you have this fossil information and can explore it comparatively with other animals, living and dead, what you can do is begin to see the history we share with other creatures on our planet. And here in particular, I'm showing the history we share with fish, and you can see the history inside the fin of a fish and the limb of our own limb, and you can trace, when you have that fossil record and that comparative anatomy, you know, the bones in a fish all the way to a human. And we can do this with our arms and legs, we can do this with our necks, on and on and on and on. And it shows our deep connection to the rest of life on our planet, which is a very beautiful thing, but also a very powerful thing. But also what these fossils can do is tell us about how these transitions actually happened. They can give us information on that. We can go from the fossils of a fish that are distantly related to the limbed animals on the bottom, and we can find these intermediates which tell us about how fins were transformed into limbs, give us some clues and insights into that, show us about the evolution of the girdles, like the hips and shoulders, and other parts of the anatomy. And that was the first lecture. The second lecture I was really asking the question is, how did fish evolve to walk? How did they deploy these new systems to move about on land? And the key take-home message from that lecture, which you're going to see appearing again and again, is the major things that are necessary for a great revolution in the history of life actually appear before the revolution itself in a different way. Indeed, fish were already walking in many key ways before our distant relatives ever took their first steps on land. And we know this from the fossil record, but we also know this from studying living fish and exploring the ways that diverse kinds of living fish can walk in the water. And they deploy those strategies later for living on land. And we also showed that we can study these fish to understand, why would a fish ever evolve to walk rather than swim? And I talked about the fish treadmill. Yes, there is a fish treadmill, and yes, fish can walk on this treadmill, and yes, we can study that to understand, you know, perhaps why fish have evolved to walk. Okay, that's where we've been, in a nutshell. Now, where are we going? What we're going today is deeper in time, because all these traits involve the origin of a bony skeleton, a hard skeleton. That is, in essence, what enables our fishy ancestors to do many of the wonderful things it does. And so this is an event that happened in the deep past. And so today we're going to talk about the origin of our hard skeleton. And that is all leading up to these three lectures, the final lecture, which will be on the origin of innovation, biological innovation, how innovation, new things happen. Okay, let's talk about our skeletons, just as an introduction. And I should say that our skeletons are very special tissues. Now, there are other animals that have hard skeletons. Think of a clam. Think of a lobster. Think of a crab. Think of insects. They have hard parts on the outside of their body. But those hard parts are different from our own skeletons for a number of reasons. And I'm only going to give you a few here. But these are really, really essential, particularly for somebody like me, a paleontologist and a developmental biologist. Our bones, vertebrate bones, which we share with other vertebrates, is a very special tissue. The first is, it can grow and adapt, it can remodel based on how it's used. It's a dynamic tissue. And it's a dynamic tissue because the cells inside are doing a variety of things we're going to be talking about today. This tissue can also heal. You break a bone, it can heal. And it's a dynamic tissue in that it can heal pretty well in many important ways. And all these things point to, when we look inside the bone, our own bones, that this, in a very real sense, this hard tissue, which seems so inert, so rock-like, is really a living tissue. And it's a living tissue because the cells inside of it are always functioning and always adapting and doing new things in response to the world we're in. Okay, so that's the predicate, that's the beginning, that's some background on what we're trying to study here. We're going to be talking about the origin of remodeling and other things today. Now, when we study bones, particularly somebody like myself, who is thinking about this as in this particular case as a paleontologist, we can think about bones at the level of cells, the different cells that make up our bones, that form the bones, that eat up the bones, that sort of thing. We can think about it at the level of tissues and how these cells and the materials that make the bones, how they're organized. And we can think about the level of whole organs. You can be a little more cheerful than that guy, but you get the idea that you have organs, tissues, and cells, levels of biological organization. Now, what's really important about bone here, and I hope that it reinforces during my own lecture today, is that as a paleontologist, bone is a great tissue to study microscopically. Why? Because by looking at the structure of bone at the tissue level in a fossil, and that is often recorded in the fossil record, it's really nice, we can begin to infer what the cells were doing. And that can tell us a lot about the basic biology of long extinct organisms. And that trick, the reason for that is that bone records faithfully what the cells are doing inside of it, because it's a hard tissue. And it preserves very well in the fossil record, so we can reasonably infer what the cells are doing here. And that gives us a tool to understand the basic biology of creatures that have been long dead for hundreds of millions of years. And if you explore the paleontological literature, what you'll find are lots of studies of bone histology, bone studies at the tissue level, of people studying dinosaurs, birds, mammals, fish. It's a real part of our discipline. What I want to do today is to ask this question, using these techniques, is what can we learn from the earliest fish? You could see a diversity of skeletons today, just go nearby. And the question is, how can we tie that into the evolution of the earliest, of what's happening in the earliest fish? You know, when did our own hard tissues, our own mineralized tissues evolve? What was their structure? What did they look like? How did they grow? And what were their functions? What can this tell us about their basic biology? These are the questions we're going to explore. Now, in these questions, when we explore the distant past, the fossil record becomes incredibly important. Let me show you. This is an evolutionary tree. It's somewhat out of date. This branch would have changed a bit, but the main point holds is that if you think about modern species alone, modern lampreys or hagfish, which are our distant relatives, or you think about modern fish, lobe-fin fish, ray-fin fish, and sharks and skates and so forth, modern species alone cannot really tell us much about the early history of bone themselves. Now, they can tell us a few things in a comparative way, don't get me wrong, but they're limited. And they're limited because, just take this particular example. If you look at the vertebrates that are alive today that we share a very distant common ancestor with, they don't have bone. They have cartilage, but no mineralized tissues. When you look at sharks that are alive today, they don't have bone. Now, they have hard tissues. They have calcified cartilage, but they don't have skeletal tissue that you would recognize as ours. Actually, these are very complex, but they don't have bone. They've lost it. But these creatures have bones. So if you look at this, and I put the asterisks there to remind me to say that these sharks and skates, that they don't have bone, but they do have complex skeletal tissues. That if you looked at this and just read it literally, bone would be the mineralized bone, the hard bone. That would be a feature of this end branch of evolution, right? But what happens when you layer in hundreds of millions of years of fossil history and diverse species and groups, what you find is that they're all composed of bone, that they have diverse kinds of bone, In fact, some of which you could not predict by understanding fossil living creatures today. And indeed, when you plot it there, it's very clear that the Chondrichthyans actually lost skeleton, right? So it changes the way you think about living creatures when you layer in fossils. Now, I put this little thing squiggling out here. This is called a conodont. This is an animal with tooth-like structures that fit somewhere in this, and it's very, really enigmatic. But I'm just laying that in there saying that there are pieces of this tree we're still debating. So the idea is jawless fish are key to understanding the evolution of our skeletons. They really are. They fill not only a gap, but they change how we think about the evolutionary changes of living creatures. And so that takes us to this wonderful world of these jawless fish, which have bone on the outside of their body. And this has been the subject of study for a long time. And it's remarkable studies and remarkable history to those studies. You cannot know this without knowing the history of the way we've studied it. And when you explore these creatures, what you see is when you look on the outside of their body, you find hard parts. You find an exoskeleton, a skeleton on the outside of their bodies, right? And when you look and break down this skeleton microscopically, what you see are a form of scales, typically scales on the outside. You see that on the outside. And then bone forming much of the stuff on the inside. Now, interior here, they likely had cartilage as well, another, but not bone, but they had probably in the interior cartilage. But this is the structure you see microscopically here. And so for the talk today, talk part one is going to be focusing on these scales. Talk part two will be focusing on these bones here. Okay, so that's how we're going to structure it today. We're going to work through these things to give you a sense of how it all came about. Now, there's something that's pretty remarkable about this tissue here. Is that when you look at these scales on the outside of the body, and you can see they sit as a, you know, almost like an arm exterior to the armor on the outside of the body, and some of them extend quite old, over 400 million years old, actually, over this number here. If you look at it microscopically, they sort of have a classic three-layered structure. On the outside, you have a very hard tissue I'm showing you in yellow. On the inside, you have a bony tissue that has tubules inside of it. And you can see I've shown these tubules as dark lines there. And then in the interior here, you have bone. Okay, so hard tissue, almost like a rock. You have this tubular tissue on the inside, and then bone even deeper still, right? Where do you see that before? Well, if you know this histologically, you see it in teeth. It's in our body. That is, these scales have a tooth-like structure to them. Where if you compare a tooth, it has enamel on the outside. It has a tubular hard tissue, bony tissue on the inside. You can see the tubules there. We call that dentine. And you have a layer of bone on the inside that forms part of our jaw. Bone, dentine, hard part. See the same thing in the scales on the outside of the body of these fish. Okay? So these ancestral scales were actually tooth-like structures, and we give them a name. We're going to call them odontodes. It implies their similarity to teeth. They're like a tooth-like structure that, in this case, sits on the outside of the body. So these ancestral scales were tooth-like structures sitting on the outside of the body. Now, there's been a lot of debate and discussion on this, but if we look at the current sort of understanding of the evolution of these scales, it suggests the hypothesis that the tooth program, the tooth-like structure, actually arose on the outside of the body. That's called the outside-in hypothesis, that the program that makes teeth evolved to make exoskeletal components, scales, and was later deployed on the inside of the mouth. So a co-option, if you will, of that program that makes that. And there's a lot of evidence to support that. Okay? And it's come into recent support. And one of the things that did that is that understanding. Remember that little squiggle I showed you at the corner of one of those slides? It's kind of where those things fit in because they have a tooth-like structure inside. Anyway, that's the nature of the debate. Now, as we begin to study this, we have a puzzle. Puzzles are good. We love puzzles, right? Except when they're too hard. Well, this one is both. It's good and too hard. Here's the puzzle. That there's this early vertebrate, there was an early vertebrate known for a long time, and one of the early publications on it, these here. It's from the late Cambrian period, it's very ancient, called Anatolepis. And it was considered by some, not all, by some, considered to be the earliest creature with mineralized tissue like our own. And it was really enigmatic, but very important because it was the earliest and potentially giving us a real window here. Now, let's break this down. Over 516 million years ago, right around the Cambrian explosion, that period of where you had lots of critter body plans arise. Soon after that, you start to see, during that and then soon after, you start to see in the Middle Cambrian, soft-bodied species like this worm-like creature here, which have versions of the vertebrate body plan, but no bone. They had versions of the body plan and they likely had a gill arches and other parts that are textbook parts of our body plan, but they didn't have bone. They likely had cartilage, but no bone. So this squishy, a lot of the history was these squishy, soft kinds of things. Then you get much later, let's look at that, by about 470 million years ago in a time period called the Middle Ordovician, you start to get species that are true vertebrates with mineralized tissue, bone like ours. Like, you know, those tooth-like scales I showed you on a slide before? We start to pick them up right here. Okay? So there's this huge gap, you know, millions and millions, tens of millions of years from squishy to hard part, right? Soft to hard part. And where this creature, this thing, Anatolepis, fit in was really in rocks that were about 490 or so million years old. Actually, it had a range of them. And it had tissues that looked a lot like bone. And I put some question marks there because it was hotly debated. Now, this is of great interest. And it was of great interest to me personally because starting this project, I was really trying to think of field expeditions that could bridge this gap, just like we did in the first lecture to try to find fossils of the right age and type. And whether or not you have a vertebrate with skeleton here makes a big difference on what kinds of rocks I would look at. Would I look at Cambrian rocks? Would I look at Ordovician rocks? There's a big time difference there. So this mattered not only for the process of finding fossils, but also for understanding what the earliest bones looked like. Right? Both for discovery, but also for understanding. That's why this puzzle really mattered, and solving it really mattered. Now, in the ideal world, in my dream world, Anatolepis, this thing, would have looked like this, would have been a whole skeleton. That's the dream of a paleontologist, that you can study a whole skeleton, that you can know the anatomy, that you can see the histology in the tissues, you can go from organ to tissue to cell. But reality has a funny way of intervening to our dreams. This is the reality of what Anatolepis was. It was a bunch of fragments that were collected from around the world of a similar age, roughly the same age, within a window of time, that had bone-like structure. You could see it shining. See that little blob there? That's considered to be one of those scale-like things, an odontode. And people got very excited by this. Okay, so the reality conflicted with our dream. My dream is in the field still to find one of these way back old, but we had to work with these fragments. So how do we do that? Well, this naturally caused a degree of discussion and debate of people making logical, concrete arguments for and against it. There were those who believed, and very prominently, that this was a Cambrian vertebrate, that this was truly an ancient vertebrate, and they were doing it, as I'll show in a second, by an analysis of their tissues inside the skeleton. And there are others that said, no, it's an invertebrate instead. And they argued that, well, no, it's more like invertebrate hard tissue rather than vertebrate hard tissue. So that's what we have. So the ones who proposed it was very much like a vertebrate is this is the proposed Anatolepis histology, the earliest mineralizing vertebrate, question mark. This is one of those odontodes. This is one of those scale-like things I was showing you earlier. Zoom in on it. And you can see inside there are a series of tubules. Remember I told you the three-layer structure, the hard stuff on the outside, the tubular stuff, which we call dentine in the middle and bone? Well, this looked like it had a tubular structure, like dentine, like maybe like a tooth, okay? And because of that tubules, a lot of ink was spilled talking about these tubules. And the reason why that's important is dentine is formed by these cells called odontoblasts that actually make these tubules. They're in there and they make the dentine matrix, the hard parts, and they retreat, and as they retreat, they make a tubule. So it implied that there were certain types of vertebrate cells in there. So this was exciting, right? You had a proposed anatomy, you had tubules, kind of like those scales we saw before. So the question really is, what is Anatolepis? And that was to begin our search here. And here's kind of fossils we were able to assemble. You could see one fragment here. You can see the interior surface of those scales. This was a body wall of one of them, putatively, supposedly. And I was particularly excited about this because if this was truly a vertebrate, these sites that produced these were only 2 hours from Chicago, where I live. So I could do, if this was a true vertebrate, I could get in the car, just like I did in Pennsylvania, and find early vertebrates. So I was pretty excited to find these as vertebrates. And this is another piece. These are from Texas. We assembled a lot of them. Now, what I'm going to be telling you is the work of one of my postdocs who really led this work. Many of these, in fact, all these slides were really in some way touched by Yara and her creativity and her perseverance in this project. Yara Haraday, she's a postdoc in my lab. And she really assembled a team of people who focus on imaging to really understand, to get to the bottom of what anatolepis is using modern imaging techniques. So this is, I'm not going to mention Yara on every slide, but I'm telling you now, Yara is on every slide that I'm showing you here. And we were fortunate also to have this facility about half an hour outside of Chicago, where our university is. This is the ring. This is Argonne National Laboratory. It's a synchrotron ring where we can use high-energy X-rays to look inside the bones at submicron scales, at the scale that's necessary to look for tissues and cells and things like that. So we had the facility to do this. And so what Yara did is it's a specialized sort of ring. It's actually geared towards sort of microscopic things. So Yara, it only can handle small things. So Yara, for months, collected every piece of anatolepis she could get. She put them on the ends of these pins. They'd be mounted here on the ring, and we'd get some quick images of them. Okay, so these are the synchrotron images, and they're micron scale. You can get submicron scale, but these are micron scale. What you're gonna see here, I don't have a scale bar, but you're gonna see a fragment of tissue. What you're gonna see here is about 400 microns in length. Okay, so now you're going to see a loop of a video. Now out here where my pointer is, follow my pointer, that's the rock. We left it in this section. So the rock is there. The bone is here. Now look in this middle section here, and you're zooming through it. I'll show this in much better detail later, but this is the first image you had where you see in there, there's a structure, a scale, that we could see the scale. But in that scale, you have, and you see it in the movie, look at that, tubules. They look like tubules running through it, right? You catch it on the movie, and they go to a pulp cavity. So very superficially, this looks like the tubules of a dentine in a vertebrate. And I'll show this to you in more detail. And so here's the more detail. You do a slice of one of these anatolepis, and here you see these external scales. Here's a slice. Here's a cleaned up version of what you just saw. It has a cap. You see the cap there. It has a cavity, and it has a series, and in this plane you're seeing, has a series of tubules. And when Yara segmented this out, and she actually prepared it digitally, what you can see is there's a series of tubules shown in green. There's a cavity here. It has the air of a vertebrate. And seeing this, we thought, well, you know, there are probably the tubules, and there you can see the tubules. This is about 300 microns. To tubules through there, maybe we have the first vertebrate. And we were actually truly happy because now we can lead field expeditions nearby Wisconsin, find early vertebrates, find more. But this is science, right? The dream and the reality, they can sometimes conflict. In fact, they often do. In fact, they probably always do. But now then we had to decide, well, we have to do the hard work of doing the comparative work. And so we had a round two of the synchrotron. We called the people who ran the synchrotron. We really needed to sample modern vertebrates, get a sense of what an encyclopedia of variation histologically using these tools, of fossil vertebrates, modern invertebrates, fossil invertebrates, over 200 scans. We wanted creatures of known provenance. We knew exactly where they're coming from, where we had whole bodies. We really needed to do all the controls. And they, getting time on these things is hard. They gave us time on the one day they had open space. They had 8 hours on Easter Sunday 2 years ago. So my lab spent Easter Sunday 2 years ago helping Yara scan these fragments. And this is where the dream and reality come back. So here's come together. So we took a common invertebrate found in the same time period, actually in Wisconsin, and here's its whole skeleton. It's a creature called, it's Cambrian. It's called an agalaspid. And this is its body plan here. You can see the body plan. And you could take known pieces of that, and when you scan it, so again, you're seeing the rocks at the base here. Again, I'm going to remove those rocks in a second. I'm just showing you the raw data. And then right there, you could start to see where one of these tubules is. And if you look, you see the spaces in black there? Those are the tubules that you can see in this thing. So when we capture it, there are tubules in these things. And indeed, when we look at it from a different angle, here is one of those little scales. You could see the tubules here. Let's watch, it's a looping movie. You can see those little spaces. You see those little spaces? Those are the tubules coming out at you right there. So this thing clearly had tubules. And it here clearly had tubules that were very similar to quote, anatolepis. So anatolepis is tubular histology, was very much like an agalaspid invertebrate. So this is not a tooth, it's probably a piece of one of those invertebrates I showed you before. We did the, always do your controls, note to self, right? So that's important. So what you have here is, you know, the thing is, reality can kill your dreams, but it can give you new ones, all right? So now we're onto a new hypothesis here. And so the idea is, here's what I showed you for anatolepis on the top, remember that slice. On the bottom, this is that invertebrate, we're calling an agalaspid. We just took it from this tail end here, and you can see the tubules there. Compare them to tubules here. You can do isolate one. You can compare them between the putative vertebrate, which is not an anatolepis, and the invertebrate. You can see the tubules in there. You can see the core cavity. And all this is very different. It's similar but distinct from a vertebrate odontode, those scales. Here's a vertebrate one from a definitive vertebrate. And one thing you see is there's the tubules, but this particular one has an enamel cap. Not all of them do, but this one does. And has bone underneath it. So it's clearly distinct but different. But all these have tubules. So the question really is, everything we scanned, every piece of armor, whether it was an invertebrate or a vertebrate scale, they all had tubules. And it's like, we got to ask the question, what are these tubules doing? And this is where discovery happens. You're disappointed on one side, but you find a whole new world in another. And you know, so what are the invertebrate tubules and bumps? Well, you look in here, and here's that agalaspid I showed you before. Remember that invertebrate, okay? And each of these little circular things you're seeing in cross-section, one of those tubules coming out at you. So you're seeing it in slice, right? That's kind of what it is there. Well, we scanned invertebrates. We scanned vertebrates, crabs, lobsters, you name it. Here's a crab. We scanned a crab claw. Here's what it looks like in micro-CT. And they have tubules as well. These knobs as well. And when you scan them, they also have tubules. So tubules are a factor in the exoskeleton of creatures, whether they're invertebrates without bone or vertebrates with bone. And when you look at these tubules, you can see them. They're organized in particular patterns. They're highly organized. And these tubules are sensory. They're innervated. It's nerves that go through those tubules. These are sensory nerves that the creatures use in their claws, in their skeleton, to perceive aspects of the world, right? That these nerve ends are being exposed to changes in pressure and salinity and chemistry and so forth. And so a crab shell is not inert in every way. It has sensory tissue in it. It's a way a creature with armor can perceive the world. If you're just wearing armor, you're blind to the world, right? That's what this enables the crabs to do. And in fact, these in many invertebrates develop into structures called sensilla. And a sensilla can have a little hair. It can be a true mechanoreceptor, a chemoreceptor. It can be part of the way that they perceive the world. So that the sensilla of invertebrates are innervated in their sensory, and that begs the question. When you see our tubule structures, like which we call odontodes, derivatives of the scales, our teeth and scales, which are derived, are odontode-like invertebrates, sensory also. And this is a hypothesis that people made years ago called the sensory odontode hypothesis. They proposed that those external scales might have had a sensory function. Well, one structure I can guarantee you is highly sensory, which is derived from odontodes. I'm sure you all know this extremely well from the trip to the dentist, our teeth. Teeth have an enamel cap, they have dentine with tubules, and it's highly sensory innervated. Our teeth, even though they're covered by enamel, are extraordinarily sensitive. And that sensitivity for teeth actually plays a role in our biting and our normal health and regulation. So teeth are sensory. What about scales? What about living creatures that have scales that are derived from odontodes, like the ones we see in the fossil creatures? And those exist in creatures like catfish, which have these scales on their heads, they have them on their fins. They exist in various types of cartilaginous fish. And so Yara looked at catfish, and it turns out that their odontodes, their scales, are innervated with sensory innervation. And in fact, you can trace them with the neurofilament marker, and you can see these branching nerves enter the pulp cavity of the scales. So tubular tissue is seen in the exoskeletons of vertebrates and invertebrates. It's a very common thing. And here you see it in a true vertebrate. Here you see it in that agalaspid arthropod, that invertebrate I showed you before. Here you see it in a crab. You could see tubular structures. Not identical, but you see tubular structures, and they're oftentimes with a separate little knob that it fits in. In living creatures, these tissues are all sensory. They have sensory innervation. So it implies that ancient odontodes likely had a sensory function as well, which sort of leads to the hypothesis that the tooth developmental programs, that what lies inside our mouth, which actually can cause us some pain today, actually arose on the outside of the body, remember that outside-in hypothesis, with a sensory function. So every time you go to the dentist, and it is unpleasant, you can thank these little fish evolving 400 or more million years ago. And it actually makes sense, because if you are to have a, as I said earlier, an armor around the body, and you're living in a world with, you know, extraordinary predators, being able to perceive that world becomes important. You can't be blind to that world. And one way to not be blind to that world is to have sensory armor. And sensory armor is composed, we believe, we hypothesize based on this comparative data, which is all pointing in the same direction, to the sensory odontode, confirming the sensory odontode hypothesis. And we can test this also on a molecular level. That's kind of what we're thinking about as well. Okay, so that's the exterior part. Now what I want to do is when we look at our skeletons, remember I opened with this as well, is thinking about bone as a special tissue because it remodels, it heals, and the cells inside make it a living tissue, that it's dynamic. And part of that dynamism when we talk about it is really based on this remodeling, which I'll just show just a simple cartoon. That is, here's a little chunk of bone as you would see it under a microscope, a cartoon of a chunk of bone as you would see it under the microscope. And you can see layer after layer here of bone tissue, and this bone tissue was laid down by bone cells. Okay, makes sense. And they lay it down appositionally on the outside. Can't grow from the inside, grows from the outside. That's why you see these layers, because it's like a laying plaster. Right? When you want to lay plaster, you lay more plaster on the outside or inside, but it's being layered on the outside, and you see layer after layer. So this layering is what you see inside the bones. And typically, you'll have a blood vessel shown in red here. You're seeing a cross-section of a cartoon of a blood vessel. And these layers will form around the blood vessel. That's where those cells will be. This is called an osteon. That's a primary osteon. Now, in remodeling, what you'll see is a class of cells known as osteoclasts. And these are big cells that are related to macrophages. They're actually more related to blood cells than they are bone cells. But they're big cells that can eat away bone. And you can see when you look at a histological section of these bones, what you can see is they actually cut through those layers. You see how you cut through the layers there? And sometimes what you'll see is after they've cut through the layers around the blood vessel, they'll form a new set of layers, what are so-called secondary osteons. So here's a primary osteon. Here's a secondary osteon. And look at this secondary osteon. By looking at the layers, you can tell that it's secondary. How can you tell it's secondary? Because this osteon is cutting through these layers. So that cut through is telling us that there were at one point osteoclasts in there chewing away the bone. Okay? So these are the dynamics that we see in remodeling bone. There are lots of other dynamics that are there. You have the action of bone-forming cells, which make these layers. You have the action of osteoclasts, which are the bone-resorbing cells, which eat away these layers. And their combined activity can yield things like this, which are osteons, the secondary osteon. You can see it there. So now you know, if you look at a sort of histological section of a fossil, and you see something, a layer like this that cuts through other layers, you know that had secondary osteons. So this is a case where in the structure of the bone, we can infer, make very reasonable inferences about what kind of cells were there, what kind of cells were present in that bone. That is, you have the bone building cells. These are the cells that are in our vertebrate cousins, all our vertebrate cousins. They make and secrete the bone matrix, the stuff that makes bone hard and gives it its connective tissue possibilities. All the way in the far end are the osteoclasts. These are the bone dissolving cells that I already talked about. They're big, they're related to blood cells, but they're the ones that eat away. And in the middle here are the osteocytes I haven't talked about yet, but these are the cells that maintain bone, and they actually sit inside little spaces of the bone. And I'll show you that in a few seconds, okay? So from a structure of a fossil bone, you can actually see whether the creature had osteoblasts, osteocytes, osteoclasts. You can do all this, and I'll show that to you in a second. So the question really is to ask, since we have these tools, when did remodeling arise? Okay, so we've already seen the external piece, That's showing that teeth and scales are related, those certain types of scales, that they're sensory. But on that interior piece, when did the ability, this special ability of our kind of bone come about? Did remodeling come about? Because I showed you in the previous slide that that leaves a signature, a histological signature. Well, there's been some really good papers on this over the years. There was a great paper done in 2009. Here's a cladogram, or a phylogeny, an evolutionary tree, show you before. And this is looking at one of these creatures, which is a jawed fish. And this fish is from rocks about 380 million years old. It's a very common fish. It's one of the most, in fact, we find them with Tiktaalik rosea, the creature I talked about in the first. It's a very unusual fish, but extremely common. And actually Jason Downs, who's on this paper, was the person who discovered the actual Tiktaalik site. He ended up going to Bristol working with Phil Donahue. But anyway, so they did a section here on the bones, and you can see in this bones exactly what I'm talking about, the signature of remodeling in this fish that's Devonian, that's around 380 million years old. What you see here are the layers. See the layers here? The different layers where my pointer are. Here you see an osteon. That's the space is where a blood vessel will be. It's called secondary osteon. And you can see the ring-like structure around that. And look at here, you can see that this ring-like structure actually cuts into those other layers. These layers truncate. They stop because they've been cut off. Clearly, bone has been eaten away and produced to make this secondary osteon. You could see that here as well. See here, these layers go one after the other after another towards this osteon, but they stop. Like they've been resorbed, and they've been replaced by this other feature, which here's the blood vessel on the inside, just a space for it, and ring-like structure around it, showing that you've had resorption on the one hand and bone deposition on the other, that you've had this orchestration of remodeling already existing in this Devonian age fish that's about 380 or so million years old. Okay, then that's how you can see. And there's another thing you can see from this slide that I think is extremely relevant here. Is look at all these black dots. These black dots, if you saw any other bone, human bone or others, they're known as lacunae, spaces. And inside those spaces lie osteocytes. That's where those bone, remember I showed you the bone maintenance cells? So you see we had signs of cutting here. I'm sorry, we had signs of cutting here from the osteoclast. We had signs of bone deposition, formation, the osteoblast. And we have lacunae, those spaces. Those are the spaces that in any other vertebrate bone, osteocytes sit in, and these are the ones that maintain bone. And all that is seen here in this 380 million-year-old fossil fish. So the whole system is already established. So it already had all major bone cells by 380 million years ago. Now, how early and in what way did this process of remodeling actually arise? Well, in those scans that Yara and the team did on Easter Sunday a couple years ago, we had true vertebrates as part of that, where we knew they came from skeletons and they were true vertebrates, and we can actually do a section through these things. This is one from Colorado, a place where we're actually doing field work now. And can do a cross-section through it using various imaging tools. And as soon as these slices came through, this is what they are, some slices came through of the interior bone. First of all, you can see these different spaces here. These are likely big vascular spaces. So there's probably lots of blood vessels in there. But when we look at this and you kind of zoom in, what you start to see is here's one osteon, there's one space, and there are rings around it. These others seem to cut right through it. You have a number of them here of different shapes, like we're doing a section unevenly here. So you clearly have secondary osteons here. And in fact, what's interesting about this is you have bone deposition in this layer here with these osteons. Look at this one here. It's clearly cut into that ring, right? So it clearly has osteoclasts by this point. But this dark band around there is actually a very special indicator of a zone between where the cells would chew away the bone and other cells would deposit the bone. It's a particular kind of line with a particular significance. And we see that. So clearly this orchestration between bone-forming cells and bone-resorbing cells already exists at the deepest level of bone, in the earliest known bone now. So now we're looking at something like a true bone that's not anatolepis from before. So we're already seeing remodeling here. And this confirms an observation that people made starting in 2015, where they saw in other fish in parts of that tree where these lines were cut off by a vascular canal, implying that you had resorption here as well. Only now we're seeing it in this particular case in the deepest part of the tree. So this means by the time we pick up the earliest vertebrates with bone, true ones with bone, we're already seeing remodeling. But when you look at this, you see something missing. Answer one question, find another. And what you see here is, here's that ostia. Now you can see the layers a little better. Here's the other one, the secondary one coming through. These are the spaces for the blood vessels. When you look at that, and I showed you that diagram earlier, something's missing. What's missing? These holes, these lacunae for the osteocytes. No lacunae. See the black dots here? Those are the spaces where the bone-maintaining cells would be, but they're not present in this early remodeling fish. So you lack the osteocytes seen here. So you have remodeling in this context, clearly. This is clear remodeling, but we're doing it without the bone-maintaining cells that other vertebrates have. So here's a case where I think the fossil record is showing us how cell type diversity evolves, because it's recording it faithfully. So you have a situation where you have remodeling without these osteocytes. Now add a little more information here. These osteoblasts, the bone-forming cells, ultimately will mature, some of them, to become an osteocyte, and they stay interconnected inside the bone. They live a long time and they maintain bone. They respond to the outside world. They coordinate remodeling. They do all sorts of things. And so from the fossil record, when we look at that interior part of the bones, bone remodeling was present in jawless fish from their earliest occurrence. Osteocytes came later, and it seems like that's significantly later in time. Now that opens up a whole new question. Like, what's happening in bone, this earliest bone that's remodeling, but it's doing it without osteocytes, without like the major bone-maintaining cells. And, you know, here's a horse, and here's a section. See, there's the dots, right? Those are the lacunae that the osteocytes fit in. These osteocytes, they function in mechanosensation in the interior of the bone. They respond to external pressures. They orchestrate remodeling. That is, they can orchestrate the activity between the bone-forming cells and the bone-resorbing cells. And they function, as all part of this, in a mineral metabolism as well, activated by hormones and so forth that are involved in hormone regulation. But we have none of that in this fish. Turns out that number of living fish that are alive today, have secondarily lost the osteoclasts. Now we can learn from them. So this is a swordfish. Compare the swordfish to the horse, and you'll notice you don't have those osteocytes in there at all, right? And what you have here in this situation is a fish that's able to remodel a little bit, but it's very limited. It's not as dynamic as, say, another vertebrate bone, but they also function at much lower metabolic cost. So this strategy of losing osteocytes actually we see evolving in a number of fish independently today. So it actually can serve a purpose in the right setting. And these are fish that tend to remodel slowly, that have lower metabolic costs. There are other arguments people have made as well, that maybe this bone is actually more resistant to fracture during bending. It's more pliable because it doesn't have these holes in it. I mean, there's all kinds of different arguments. But this is the model we're using to understand the dynamics of what's happening in those fossils. Now we have a tool and questions to ask to explore, you know, utilize what's happening, what's the dynamism between the different cell types in a living fish that's lost the osteocytes, to give us a window, perhaps, to understand what might have happened in the distant past. So to think about where we've been, the earliest tooth-like structures had a sensory function on the outside of the body. We were able to show that that creature Anatolepis is probably not a creature. It was more of an artifact. And that we now still have a long gap in the fossil record, which hopefully we'll be able to fill with field work, me or colleagues who are doing similar work. The earliest bones had highly complex remodeling, already there. It was already present, but they lacked the osteocytes. And what this together they enable us to do, where they do is to set us up for the next lecture, is to see that we have innovation by the origin of new cell types. That is, that's the way skeletons evolve. They evolve by the origin of new cell types that make the skeleton, that help it remodel and so forth. But also by a change in function. That something can arise by functioning in one context, maybe as partially as a sensory structure in one setting, and then be redeployed to function in a new one. These tools of adding cell types, of changing function, are ways that evolution has acted over billions of years, and in the case of vertebrates, hundreds of millions of years, to evolve new organs and new structures and new ways of living. And that tees us up for the next lecture for next Friday, where we're going to look at innovation in evolution. A Nobel Prize was won here at the Collège a couple weeks back for innovation in the technological and social sphere, and the understanding that. Well, biological systems have themselves been innovating with new organs, new tissues, new ways of life for billions of years. And are there lessons to learn from that? Are there lessons to think about and how new things can arise by looking at biological innovation, evolutionary innovation over long periods of time? And the lecture will begin, I think, quite appropriately with somebody whose work was very fundamental to my way of thinking in innovation, someone who is a part of, it's very fitting to talk about him in this setting, François Jacob. François Jacob was really important, as you'll see as I begin my next lecture, in identifying an approach and a way of thinking about how major new innovations can arise in evolution. And we'll pull all together in that one, the origin of tetrapods, the origin of bones, and many of the things we have talked about already. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.